We were getting it right.
Did it good. All right. Well, we'll get started here. All right, you are tuned to KGV in Bozeman. We are the audio mirror of the Gallatin Valley, and you can find us on the radio dial at 95.9 FM and find us online at kgvm.org. And so since it's 7 o'clock on Wednesday night, it's time for the local musician spotlight. And full disclosure, I was not able to do it live this week, but that gave me an opportunity to take a field trip down the Paradise Valley and get to spend some time with Sean Devine. Thanks for coming on the show, Sean.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, and welcome to my studio.
Yeah.
It can be Wednesday night at 7 if you like. I don't care. I don't keep track of time that carefully anyway.
Well, that's all right. That's a good way to do it, I think. So, just kind of some basics. How long have you been doing music and playing music for a living?
Yeah, how long has that been? As we were just talking about off camera, Bob, it's been a long, long time, and a very colorful time, and mostly here in Montana. Actually, I was in a bar band with my dad and my uncle and a couple other fellows. We were called the Decorations, and we were playing the Montana bar scene starting in 1987. When I was 18 years old, I wasn't old enough to be in any of those places where we were working, except I was a musician, and you can do that, as you probably know. And then over the course of being in that band for a few years, it kind of worked out that I got to know some people, and then it didn't seem to matter anymore if I wasn't old enough to be in there. I could still go to the joints where we worked and go hear bands at the filling station, for instance, or the Molly Brown or the Cat's Paw or Little John's. Or what was that one out on 19th? The Sundance Saloon.
Yeah.
And of course, at the Long Branch here in Livingston was our home club. Long Branch. We'd venture out and always come back to the Long Branch. Most of those joints aren't here anymore.
Yeah.
Bob, you've probably noticed that.
Yeah, for a period of time, it seemed like some sort of plague struck a lot of those places. And I remember I started college in 82 and man, spent more than a couple nights in the Molly Brown and the Sundance and the Cat's Paw. And then when the drinking age went to 21, I think that had an effect. But then after that, I don't know what happened, but it seemed like people stopped going out to see live music, or live music stopped coming around, but the number of places that had it seemed to really plummet there for a while. And
I noticed that, actually. I noticed that, too. I don't know. I'm sure there are good explanations, and I just don't know what all of them are. My observation had been that when I was a kid playing those rooms, except for the Hofbräu, where I played a single on weeknights, actually, I'd do a single. And that was right about the time that Scott Tucker showed back up in town. The Coulter Band had broke up, and he was coming playing alternating weekends at the Hof. And I got to know him back then pretty well. And that crowd and that scene seems to have stayed the same, actually. Somehow the Hofbräu.
it's kind of like some sort of Jurassic Park.
It
of
still
music.
Smells the same when I walk in the door, and it feels, and it's fun that way, actually. I enjoy that it stayed the same. But all those other places, when I was a kid, it seemed like everybody was quite a bit older than me. And a lot of those people, I think, just aged out. You know, they don't go out to hear bands anymore. And it turns out they were part of a culture of Americans for whom going out to hear a band was a normal form of entertainment on the weekends. That was part of the normal cycle of your experience. You work all week and make some money and go party on the weekends where live bands were playing. That was what you did.
Yeah.
And the entertainment options diversified a lot at the same time that those, let's call them the baby boomers, weren't coming out as much, mm-hmm. you know, and then people from my generation Well, in the first place, there aren't as many of us.
Yeah.
The children of the baby boomers are only half as many, I think, roughly. And then we, I don't know, we became victims to like home movie rentals.
Couch gravity,
cable TV and stuff, which was new, you know, those were new things.
Yeah.
And it's just started to change the people's decision-making process. And I don't know that, I mean, in some ways I miss that. In some ways I still see it happening. There's a live band in the Murray Bar playing in the summer. I think it's every night of the week here in Livingston. So there's always, that kind of entertainment is always available. I don't feel starved for it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel like we entertainers kind of taken it upon ourselves to diversify them right back. You know, because yeah. There was pretty much one format when I started out, and it was a 4 or 5 piece combo, bass, drums, and electric guitars. And that was what you did if you wanted to play music. You got a band like that together and learned, 40 songs. And then the typical thing was you went out and played those 40 songs for about 4 years until everybody got sick of each other and the songs. And everything about, and somebody get married or had to move away, and then the band broke up.
Yeah.
And then if you really like that experience, like I've regarded myself as a music business professional by the time the Decorations broke up. So I got involved in starting another band called The Daily Planet, and we took it right back around the big loop, you know, about 4 years of playing the same 40 songs. It was a college rock kind of band. We were playing Oingo Boingo and The Replacements, and REM. We were on the 4th of July float in the Bozeman parade on the Moose. We were on the Moose float. It's really fun, and I hope I don't sound like I'm disparaging any of that, because it was really fun. But I like that there are different things going on in live music, even around here.
Yeah,
more and more, you know, that there are just different offerings, and you have more to choose from that way too.
That's kind of amazing how, you know, I've talked to other people about that too, how, you know, and it's always been kind of questionable trying to assign a genre to somebody's music and stuff, but it's getting way harder, I think, around Bozeman and around this area. It's like, man, people are just, they're doing their own thing. They're not trying to fit in a bucket.
I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
I hope that, and we were talking about this too off camera. I can't help but refer. It just sounds funny to me, because the conversation that we're having for your show now is just part of a conversation that we've been having a little while now. The idea that when Montana music finally arrives on the national scene, there won't be anything to call it but Montana music, you know, because we won't have just acquired somebody else's thing. We didn't just copy and make and put our own like stamp on it somehow. I think the creative artists in Montana have by and large been doing a really good job of just digging deep in themselves and coming up with something that's really real.
Yeah, deeply personal.
That's authentic and real, and everybody has their own voice out there. I mean, for the most part, you know, they're always going to be the process of being a young artist is a process of imitation, and I think necessarily so.
Mm-hmm.
We all do that, but finally, that if that process is going well, then you imitate while you assimilate and digest all those influences, and then eventually you have this thing that you recognize as your own voice, which had to be kind of composed of all the stuff that turned you on, that made you want to play and sing and put up with all the hassle of being a musician and stuff, because you just like you attached yourself to a feeling early on.
Yeah.
But I think we don't, you know, we talked earlier too about me making records in Texas and going and playing that music scene, which I really deeply admire. I mean, the Texas music culture is, as far as I know, in the U.S., it's really its own kind of thing. It's generational. you know, the support that those creative artists have. And especially songwriting. There's a culture of songwriting in Texas that goes back generations that's on the street level. Like anybody that you might meet in a coffee shop or a diner, if you start up a conversation and if you look like I look, they're probably going to go, oh, you're probably a musician. And I'm like, yeah, well, what are you doing? Oh, I write songs. Oh, yeah. And they want to talk about songwriters and songwriting, and they've got a lot of names that goes with their appreciation of that. I love being able to participate in that culture, and I hope that it never comes to pass that people listen to the music that I come back with from all this experience, you know, of listening and acquiring impressions as I go along. I hope it never comes to pass that people think that I sound like somebody or something, right, you know, right. I feel like I'm wary of that, but I also feel like it's necessary to, you have to adventure with this to just, it's like Paul Simon going to South Africa and making a record with that big vocal group. Mm-hmm. I can't remember their name right now, but everybody knows who I mean, you know, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. And he still managed to make immediately recognizable Paul Simon songs.
Right.
Halfway around the world from New York City where he's from, you know, and so that the same guy that made Late in the Evening with the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, by the way, right in Alabama. I mean, I think he's a really stellar example of somebody who maintained an authentic voice that is his own voice, and his songwriting and his style is absolutely immediately recognizable as Paul Simon. And he's been able to take it around the world and mix it with all these influences from everywhere,
yeah,
and come back with just stunning results,
right,
over and over and over for 50 years.
Yeah. I think that's really that's a like a great example. I mean, how sad would it have been if Paul Simon had decided that, you know, no, I shouldn't go experiment with maybe this African music because that's not my thing, right?
Yeah,
no,
I should stay in
New York and do my New York things. Like, man, that would have been a pretty major loss, right? Not getting that Graceland album. It's like, man, that would be a bummer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that. For me, that's the thing. I personally need to do that. And I didn't even know. It hadn't even made sense to me that I'd actually been admiring Texas songwriters for a long time before I ever set foot in that state. Like Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt and Steve Earle and on and on and on. Lyle Lovett made a huge impression on me. And he made a record called Step Inside This House back in the early 90s that was cover songs, a double album of cover songs from Texas songwriters that he personally admires. He had all that to draw from.
Yeah.
And that's where I heard about people like Stephen Fromholtz and who's that guy? The guy that's perpetually working on his second album, and he's Willis Allen Ramsey. And he's brilliant, just amazing. And talk about having your own sound, man, Willis Allen Ramsey. Yeah, so I hope I managed to stay creative and searching and keep it interesting until I kick off the edge of this big flat earth, you know?
Yeah.
So much out there.
That's for sure. Wonder if you want to play a couple songs.
Nah, I'm too busy talking. I don't have time for that.
I was kidding. That ain't no part of nothing.
Excuse me. Well, earlier you mentioned this new album that I'm working on, which I did record in Texas with Texas musicians, actually, because I, you know, you just stepped into an opportunity there. That's a good one. I'm really excited about it, too. This is the title track from this new record. It's called Here for It All. Hanging on in my mind like a bird on a line, feeling shaky, weak, and small. You're gonna answer when I call. been awake for too many days, mixing fear and alcohol. You're gonna catch me when I fall. Well, it's been a long wait, and it feels like fate. You showed up in my life. Doesn't feel quite real, but it sure feels right. You seem to know how it's supposed to go, this story we've begun to write. Just say, just stick with me, boy, we'll have a ball. Here for it all. I was in my prime, I was doing fine, riding high, standing tall. The road I chose, I was in for the long haul. Something changed, it all went strange, if there were reasons I can't recall. Felt like my faith was my downfall. Turned to night and nothing felt right. Just some papers I had to sign. The end of my world on an empty line. But the kids to feed and their home to keep, I had to stand up for what's mine. My shoulders square, my back up against the wall. Here for it all. Full of stars, saying you can believe in me. And I know a faith that will set you free. And I see your face in that far off place, and it's where I wanna be. I'll get to you if I have to crawl. Here for it all.
Have the sequence picked out for the album yet? Is that going to be the lead-off cut? Or
that is the first song, and yes, I do actually have the sequence figured out already. That song will be followed by this song. If you'd like me to just keep playing,
sure. Yeah.
It's just a little romantic number that I wrote for this girl who's been confusing me for the past 6 or 7 years now. As I was saying earlier, I guess I gotta stop doing that. We're excluding people from the conversation. I couldn't figure out exactly what was going on with this particular woman, except that she's very attractive and enchanting, and as I said, confusing me a lot. So I just, I just went ahead and married her, because what else are you going to do?
Sometimes it comes down to that.
I used to think she was crazy, hell on wheels with the pedal down. Man, she blew right past me into the curve without slowing down. I tried to keep my eyes on her while my head spun around. The way she was moving almost lost her in a crowd. know she's out of her mind. She says she wants to be mine. I don't know what I did, don't know what I'm gonna do. I'm hearing angels calling, maybe the sky is falling. I feel like I'm rising into the blue. I think I might be crazy too. I can't say I was looking to be feeling like a fool. If I could, I would take my time, try to find out what is true. You don't see something like that coming, isn't too much you could do. I don't know how you would slow that down, even if you wanted to. Yes, I know she's out of her mind. She says she wants to be mine. Gonna hang on and see what this turns into. I'm hearing music playing, it feels like the world is swaying. I can't help dancing to the tune. I think I might be crazy. Yes, I know she's out of her mind. She says she wants to be mine. I don't know what I did, don't know what I'm gonna do. I'm hearing angels calling, maybe the sky is falling. I feel like I'm rising into the blue. I think I might be crazy.
So I've been kind of curious, like when you went to make this album, did you had you pretty much worked out all of those songs before you headed down to record, or
no? Not because I didn't mean to, and that's a good idea to do that. Actually, as you probably know, that's called pre-production, and we're supposed to, like with Austin Blues, I spent, I don't know, a good 6 weeks here at home. I recorded every song, and I with a click track actually, and I figured out the tempo that felt comfortable, and the arrangement and everything. I had it dialed in. The theory being that when you get in the room with the session musicians and the tape is rolling, which in the case of Austin Blues was literally the case, we recorded on tape, which is an expensive and unforgiving format. About the sound, you know.
Yeah.
So I had all those things figured out, and that paid off. We'd ended up not using a click track on that record because, I guess, because I'd trained with it and people were comfortable relying on me to set the tempo, and then of course the drummer was really good, and yeah, everything was solid that way, and it felt really comfortable. And in the case of this record, this is the first time, ironically, that I'd ever hired a producer. And the producer, the first thing we did is I had 26 unrecorded titles, and I made demos of them on my smartphone, you know, voice memo things, and then I just put them all in a Dropbox. And he spent about 3 months, I guess, piddling through those 26 songs and writing down titles that he thought was, that he liked. I just invited him to make the Sean Divine record that he wanted to hear, because I'd had myself all to myself all these years, and I was like craving some outside perspective, you know, mm-hmm. Like, what do you think? What should I do? And it was fun that way, but he really, after all the time he had with that Dropbox, he really dragged his feet on sending me back a list. And to the point where I started to think, maybe he just wants me to come up with the list. Because by then we were going in the studio in, I think, a couple of weeks. And I still didn't know which songs he wanted to cut. And I was getting a little nervous about that. So I put together my own list of like a dozen titles. And I charted them, and I did all the pre-pro in 2 weeks that you can do. I was rehearsing with the metronome and really committing to arrangements. I was ready to lead a studio band through these 12 songs, blindfolded, one hand tied behind my back. And we got to the studio outside of El Paso, which is kind of its own journey, you know, just getting to this place, the Sonic Ranch, out down on the Mexico border. And they'd already been working there. These guys happened to be Cody Jenks' band. He's a really popular independent artist in country music at this point. And the producer is the bass player in the band, and he's produced Cody's last half dozen records, and they've been successful. So this was a big opportunity for me to make a record with these guys. I didn't even know that Cody's band would be the session band until... Again, maybe a couple of weeks before we actually went in the studio. I hadn't heard from Josh, the producer, about who would be, like, instrumentation. Like, what kind of sonic landscape are we thinking, Josh? What what exactly are you going to do? Those guys were busy, you know, and they're living on a bus a lot of the time and playing good-sized shows. I mean, at this point, they left the studio at the end of helping me make my record, and within a couple of weeks they were playing a sold-out show at Red Rocks, for instance. So I understood Josh is busy. I mean, I just wanted to be prepared to do my part. And we got to the studio, and that was when he showed me this list of songs that he'd picked out that had a few in common with my list, happily. But even the ones that he did have in common, he was like, yeah, we've been listening to these songs and we've worked up some charts. So you don't have to worry about that. This song here, I think we should change the key, for instance, from D to a C. And the feel, actually, I think, it was crazy, too. This song I just played for you that I'd written as kind of a straight-ahead rocker. I was thinking of it as a boom-slap kind of rocking song. And he thought it would sound much better as a two-step style grew, which I didn't even grow up playing in country bands, and I wasn't even sure what that meant. Like, what does that mean, a two-step? So he started, like, dancing around, humming my song, showing me literally the dance move, like this, man. And that was when I just had to throw in the towel and say, okay, Josh, you guys just, I'll play and sing along with you, and you just play the song like you want to. It made a really nice recording of it, but I don't know if that was deliberate on his part, you know, so that I wouldn't over-prepare at home and come in with a really rigid mindset about what was supposed to happen, because he's working with this band that obviously they have a lot of experience playing together, and they're very confident that it's going to come out nice. And I'm the new guy coming in from Montana going like, what do I do, you know? What do you want me to do? And basically what he wanted me to do for the most part was just shut up and sing. You know, when I tell you to play this song, I want you to play this song. And then, like, you know, go sit down. So I did. And I got to say, that worked out, you know, really well. Yeah. Actually, it worked out really well. Those guys are killer band and great musicians and a lot of fun, by the way, to work with and hang out with in the studio. It was a blast making the thing. I worried for a while that we were just, it seemed like it was, I was having so much fun with it, and it was such a light touch for me that I felt like this is way too indulgent. This can't possibly turn out to be a serious, a real record, because I'm not even...
Didn't put enough sweat and blood into it.
Yeah, you know, like I really labored over Austin Blues in that way. We still cut the whole record live to the tape machine in 3 days, but they were 3 days of really intense.
Yeah,
we cut every song. Basically, we did a run through, because we didn't have a lot of rehearsal, and those musicians weren't a band. They were players from all over the Austin scene that I'd gotten to know in just a couple of years that I'd been going there and playing. Old friends of Quenby's, my wife, some of them, she introduced me to these people, and they're really good people, and I knew I was in good company and that we'd be all right, but we didn't have very much pre-production time together. We were in the studio, and we did I had everything charted, as I said, and we'd do a run-through off the tape, and then have a conversation about what do people think, and essentially everybody in the room, including the sound engineer, offered a suggestion at some point that is reflected in that record. It was really a creative group, and everybody was showed up with their heart in it. They really wanted to be as cool a thing as it could be. It was amazing that way. And then we would, based on everybody's agreement about how to proceed, then we would print one and then go listen to playback and then have another conversation about, like, so what do you think? How's that ending? You know, maybe we should change the head or some way that we... And we'd hear from everybody, and then we'd go back and print another one and then move on.
Yeah.
So that at the end, I had two recordings of each song and just to pick the best one of the two to mix down.
Yeah.
And we did a little bit of overdubbing with, you know, people who couldn't be in the room that day would come the next day and overdub something. But for the most part, it was played live to the tape by the musicians in the room. And I was, I guess, producing the record, you know, from the hot seat with my guitar in my lap, recording the vocal and guitar performances that are on the record.
Yeah.
There was no editing, no overdub, no final vocal. Some people, I think, would rightly say that the record suffers from that. It would have been better if I'd gone back and redone my parts at the end. And I'm sure they have a point about that. I mean, if you're looking for authenticity, you know, that record has that in spades.
Yeah.
It really was that group of musicians playing those songs that day in that room. We captured that thing. Mm-hmm. And we didn't tinker with it.
Yeah.
This record, we did quite a bit of tinkering with stuff. We played most of the rhythm tracks live, but then I did go back and record final guitar, final vocals, separate tracks. More of a traditional way of doing a multi-track recording.
Yeah.
And a lot more work in a way, but in another way, with Josh directing everything and directing his own band through the stuff while I was like outside having a cup of coffee on a bench. You know, just waiting for somebody to say they want me to do something.
Yeah.
It felt pretty easy, like I was getting away with something that way. But gosh, I can't wait for everybody to hear. I mean, I really can't. Everybody who's making a record says that, and they all mean it. You know, they do. I get that. In this case, this is my authentic voice saying, this is going to be a really cool record. And I think we're pretty nearly done with the mixdown, actually. I just had a conversation with the mix engineer a couple of days ago, and we're combing through, like, the lead vocal and listening for little weird sounds or the sibilance that didn't quite pop, you know, things that can be adjusted, little volume stuff, and just to make sure that the songs that we've picked out to be singles that we're going to promote to radio and stuff, that they're really solid.
Yeah.
Really playing solid. And I think there's one or two little tweaks we talked about that I'm just waiting to hear those tweaks, you know, the final print of things where he did a little thing here and a little thing there. And then it'll be ready to go to mastering. And then it'll be ready to release as a digital product. And it'll be sometime after that before I can afford to print up any tangible things. Self-financing is it isn't a cheap record, Bob.
Yeah.
And I don't ever really aspire to make a cheap record.
Yeah.
You know, I made a living as a contractor for a little while, and right through the heart of the Great Recession, I was trying to make a living as a contractor while still being a musician and having a band and playing every weekend. We were a two-story ranch, and we worked all the time, but I also had a little contracting business going, and I ended up when all the money just dried up or blew away or whatever happened there in the summer of 08.
Vaporized.
Something happened for sure that made a big difference. That was the sound of snow sliding off my new steel roof. And I can tell you, last winter this time, I didn't have steel roof. I was only halfway through re-roofing this building, and the halfway that I was through was that I had the underlayment on.
When all that snow started
falling. I did a whole winter with the tar paper roof. I don't recommend that. Anybody out there in radio land, that's a nerve-wracking experience. And now, but this is the first time I've had steel roof on this place, and I've been here 18 years. And so this is new for me. I hear these big moving sounds, this big sliding, grinding noises. I'm like, oh no, we're losing part of it. And it turns out to be just snow sliding off my new steel roof.
It's working the way
God,
it's supposed
to. I'm happy with that. Anyway, we'll make some vinyl records and some CDs, I guess, out of it. Some people still buy CDs. Do you buy CDs, Bob?
I do. I'm a little bit of a throwback. It's kind of funny because I only listen to them on my computer pretty much. So I go buy the CD, rip it, put it on a shelf, and it pretty much never comes off the shelf again. But I still like to go and buy the CD. It's kind of funny. I haven't gone all the way back to trying to go out and seek out new vinyl. I know a lot of people are getting back into that, you know, want to buy new on LPs. And I do think that there's something about them sounding better, but apparently there's part of me that's pretty lazy too, and it's like, well, it's a lot easier to rip a CD than it is to go and record it, you know, because inevitably I throw the record on the turntable and start recording it, my cat decides that's the time to go jump on the table and, you know.
Cats. I mean, yeah.
But I still, you know, once in a while now, like I'll go on Bandcamp or something and find digital music, but there's still some part of me that likes to have that physical thing to hold on to and to stick on that shelf somewhere.
Me too. Well, as you can see behind you, there's a lot of records on those shelves and a turntable right there. And then there are three times that many more up in the house and another turntable up there that we listen to music on. And you know, the thing I miss most, honestly, I started using Apple Music because I'm traveling more and more, and the van just has AM/FM radio.
Yeah.
And people are always telling me I should check out this artist or that artist. And I think, yeah, well, next time I'm at a record store, I'll try to remember that name that you just told me. And that never happens.
Yeah.
But it turns out you can just whip out the smartphone and go, oh, let's just search that person up right now. And I've got the earbuds in and I'm driving down the road going, hey, I am checking out that artist you just said. Hey, I like Chuck Hawthorne. Hey, I like Jamie Lynn Wilson. Hey, I like Matt Harlan. And but there's no liner notes.
Yeah, that's,
I really miss the pictures and the liner notes and the feeling of like you get to participate in an experience, you know, mm-hmm. when you're holding the record and you open it up and you look at the printed materials and you feel like you're participating in some way in this event, you know, this story that happened. And I spent my whole life obsessing over liner notes. I like to know who wrote the song. I like to know who played the bass.
Mm-hmm.
I like to know where it was recorded, who was producing. And if there's liner notes written by somebody else about the artist, I want to read all that every time. And I still do. I go buy a record and I sit and read the liner notes while I'm listening to the record for the first time. And that's a very pleasurable experience that you kids are missing out on. You hear?
That's right.
So,
and get off my lawn.
And get off my... And go get yourself some vinyl records.
That's right.
Damn it. Here's another track that I was kind of surprised. I had just written the thing and I didn't even know what to think of it. I honestly didn't think very much of it yet. Felt kind of fragmented or just awkward or weird in some way. And Josh wanted to cut it. He heard something in it right away. So we made a record of it that I think is outstanding. Just totally surprised me what they did with it and how it worked out. And I wrote it right here. There was the last summer, the first day that I can remember ever being outside when it was 100 degrees. because I grew up around here and it's just not 100 degrees very often, or if it's ever been, I don't know.
Yeah.
But the forecast said it was going to be 101 one day last summer, and I'm sorry, summer before, because last summer is when we made the record. Summer before that, 18. I was impressed with that, and I was in here shaded up and just watching the weather thing on the phone. The weather station down at the airport east of town. And when it said that the temperature at the airport was, I think it actually made 101 degrees, I was like, okay, here we go. So I put on my straw hat and my sunglasses and my flip-flops, and I went out and walked around just like over to the fence and maybe up by the county road, and then come right back down in here.
Go hunker down
like,
again.
It was maybe 4 minute stops, and I was like, whoa. It's hot. And I don't know what I'd started writing on this song anyway, because it was a thing my buddy Kevin Toll brought over, this idea. And actually, the title, I stole this from my friend Kevin Toll. Straight across. I don't have any business singing this song at all, really. But I wasn't getting very far writing on this idea until, and then after I'd been out and got scorched for a minute, and I sat back down and I went back to work. Work, we call that.
Yeah.
And I came up with the first verse, and then I was rolling. It was like, the south wind is howling, you don't bend, you're gonna break. Won't bring no rain. I've had all of this heat that I can't take. Feels like the ground's on fire. Grass is crackling beneath my shoes. Run to the river, but I'm planted here so low that I can't move. Some water, get it for myself if I could. But I'm stuck here in the ground, feeling like an old piece of wood. Says I'm lazy. She don't know what's in my mind. I'm building us a mansion, going slow, taking my time. There's a million things that I could do, probably one or two I should. I'm sitting in my easy chair, feeling like an old piece of wood. So take me into that river, you know I'm bound to float away. Down to the Mississippi, gonna see that ocean someday. I've been stuck here in this ground. I got deep roots beneath my feet. Just staring at the same old sky. Might have grown into a tree. Well, Lord, I ain't complaining, and I don't know as I'd change it if I could. Just stuck here in the ground, I'm feeling like an old piece of wood. Change it if I could. I ain't gonna be no nothing else. I'm just feeling like an old piece of wood. Yeah, I ain't gonna be no nothing else. I'm just feeling like an old piece of wood.
I'm glad that he found something in there that he thought merited getting it on a recording.
Oh, yeah, me too, actually. That, well, again, I just kind of can't wait for you to hear it. Actually, we tracked the song, one of the first songs we did when we got together there in at Sonic Ranch, was feeling like an old piece of wood. And the feel, the groove that the guys had got together for that, because again, they'd been listening to the songs that they knew they were going to record before I got there. I hadn't really rehearsed it much. It was a new song, and I was kind of uncertain about it. And so we played it and tracked it a couple times. And this was recorded to a computer, so we weren't limited like with the tape, where I only had so much tape, and we could just do two prints. On the computer, we laid down a lot more stuff. And that was for the best in that case, because we'd worked it a while and just wasn't really turning everybody on. You know, we'd listen to playback and go, I don't know, man, maybe. And so Josh just said, let's move on. Let's do a different song. And we got into some material that we felt kind of more confident about and got some momentum going and ended up having a good, productive day. And then, this lead guitar player guy, he's from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I think a lifelong Dallas guy. He has that definitive, like, Texas country telly sound. I mean, he just grew up that way. He's like grew out of the ground playing a guitar that way. It's just amazing what he does. But he also has he's about my age, and me and Chris turned out to be a little bit older than the rest of the guys on the recording crew, so we had that in common. And he had a feeling about that song, you know, and a feeling that I wasn't sold yet, you know. So anyway, he's got a pretty cool way of being helpful. Chris doesn't say much, like hardly nothing. Like he just nods mostly, or he doesn't really talk. And after we'd break for the day, about 11 o'clock at night, usually it would be, we'd break for the day. And then there's a big dirt lot out in front of this. It's a pecan farm. Sonic Ranch. It's still a working pecan farm. There's rows of trees and tractors going by at night spraying God knows what. So we're there's these old ag buildings on the place. The new owners have been remodeling into recording studios. I don't know why, but that was their concept, and it's working. We were not the only project at Sonic Ranch that time when we were there. It's a pretty busy operation, I understand. And as a matter of fact, the Little Smokies from Missoula just did a record at that same... We didn't consult each other at all about that. Just happened. It was a coincidence that they'd just gone to Sonic Ranch to do that, too. Anyway, there's a dirt lot out in front of this old... Basically an old machine shed that had been converted into a recording studio where we're working. And the ritual was to go out and make a bonfire and sit around the fire and have some beers and talk about it, you know. Which is a great technique for like morale building, bonding, all that stuff. It works. I highly recommend the bonfire thing after a day's work. And Chris, the lead guitar player, so Josh has got, he's playing music from his phone on a little Bluetooth speaker, just sitting on a table by the bonfire. We're just grooving on whatever anybody's in the mood for. And Chris says, hey, why don't you put on that old J.J. Cale record? You know, the one. It's sitting right there, I think. I can't read it from here, but I think the title is just J.J. Cale, yeah, or maybe yeah. It's After Midnight, or whatever that title is. But it's literally sitting on the floor just out of view. And so Josh's like, yeah, that sounds cool. Let's hunt that up. And after a few minutes, we're all sitting listening. Just heads are bopping along to this cool J.J. Cale record. Everybody's going, ah, he was so good, man. He was so cool. Oh, J.J. just rocked. I love J.J. Cale. And then we gradually realize, oh, we should check that out for a kind of feel for the feeling like an old piece of wood song. Maybe we should try to get this. I guess you'd call it the Tulsa groove. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the next morning, before I even was up and back in the room, those guys were already in there, and they had recut the rhythm tracks to Feeling Like an Old Piece of Wood. Same tempo, using my vocal and guitar track for it, but just a totally different feel. And when the first time I heard it, I instantly realized that they had taken the J.J. Cale hint from the night before, straight back to work. And I mean, that was one of the coolest, you know. Chris Clarity wasn't technically the producer in that moment. But that was a really cool way of contributing to yeah. that song, I felt. Really, really cool. So we ended up with this, I don't know, it sounds J.J. Cale, it sounds a little Tony Joe White, you know, it's got a slack, slow, kind of swampy groove to it. There was a Wurlitzer electric piano in the room, which is like, for those of you in radio land may not be familiar, that when Ray Charles went electric from acoustic piano to electric, it was a Wurlitzer electric piano. So think of that piano riff on like What I Say, you know, mm-hmm. that you can turn it up and it starts to distort like an older guitar amp. And that sound, so we had that sound. And a piano player on the session, and he's fooling around with the whirly, you know, getting that. And it was just, that was the gel, you know, that slack, laid back, deep groove with the whirly piano, just playing the riffs. That nailed it, and everything was, we were all sold on the song and the feel and the vibe, and it came all the way back to a Dropbox here on my computer, and I was listening to it months later and thinking, it just doesn't, there isn't a lead instrument. We're so in the pocket and feeling this groove, but nobody actually steps out and takes any kind of solo. There didn't turn out to be a lead on it, and I felt like it was just missing that. And I talked with Josh about that, and we eventually agreed that we should do something with somebody. What should we do? And by now, the project is at a mixing studio in Austin where it's being mixed. And I know some people in the Austin scene, right? So I was like, let me call. Let me just call somebody. And so my friend Jeff Plankenhorn, who plays a slide guitar that he designed called The Plank, which is kind of like a lap steel with a guitar shaped body with magnetic pickups uh-huh. in it. It's its own hybrid thing, this plank that Jeff invented. That's his namesake guitar now. And he gets a very definitive sound with that. And I decided, let's hear how the plank would sound playing slide guitar on Feeling Like an Old Piece of Wood. And that turned out to be a very serendipitous choice, because ever since that we put that on there, it's been just irresistible. Sometimes I go and plug the headphones into my phone and just listen to that song.
Yeah,
just because I hadn't heard it for, you know, 15 or 20 minutes.
it's awesome when a song does that to you, even if it's your own song, right?
Yes, it's especially awesome when it's your own song, and especially when it's a song that just seemed to have taken shape and form through the recording process.
Yeah.
I can't pretend to have really understood the song until recently, and now I hear it and I think, well, I think we got it, you know, the song that it was trying to be since it started out on paper here on my writing desk, to now it's this thing that I didn't know that was going to happen, you know? I just followed this song. And so did a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Like it was trying to do this for itself.
it was going to will itself into being, yeah. In spite of your best efforts to stop it.
And it turns out it's quite a thing. It's, what else you got, Bob? By way of changing the subject.
Well, if you wanted, we've got time. If you want to do another song, it'd be awesome.
Why don't I just play the last song from the album then? We skipped over some stuff, folks. But all that'll be available here shortly, I think. Well, I mean, it's hard to say for sure, but I should have a digital release ready to go sometime in April. I see that as being a real, real strong likelihood where you'd be able to, for instance, stream it on your radio.
Yeah.
Do you do that where you stream stuff like...
Yeah.
If I sent you a link to SoundCloud page, for instance, sure, where it's the high-res files and not just MP3s. That is the guard dog, some of you may have heard. She's out guarding.
Doing her thing.
This is the last song on this album. And it's called Can I Get a Witness? Another song about a broken dream. No, it's probably just what you need while you're busting ass and barely getting by. I could tell you some stories, my friend. You could tell them right back again. How you had to keep moving when you couldn't even stop and cry. Something's always pulled you through when you knew there was nothing left of you and all you really had. One more try. Well, can I get a witness? Can I get an amen? What was it we used to say when we saw that light again? Can I get a witness? Can I get a hallelujah? It's another day. Good things coming to you. Can I get a witness? How it goes. It's sometimes high, sometimes low, but you're keeping on like there's any other way. You're going up or coming down, sometimes spinning round and round every morning, thinking this could be the day, the first day of the rest of my life. From now on, I'm gonna do this right. If you're feeling it too, let me hear you say, can I get a witness? Can I get an amen? What was it we used to say when we saw that light again? Can I get a witness? Can I get a hallelujah? It's another day, good things coming to you. Can I get a witness?
Seems like a pretty nice way to end the album. Well, you've been tuned to the Local Musician Spotlight. We'll be back again next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. But hope you've enjoyed this. And when the record comes out, we'll be sure to get some cuts up on KGVM for people to listen to. So tune back in next week and keep it tuned here now. Forrest's electronic music show is coming up next, but we'll be back again with another local artist next week.